is Breaking Free from Narcissistic Abuse, and I'm your host, Dr. Carrie McAvoy. What are we supposed to do when the narcissistic ex is using the court system to abuse us? This is one of the many questions we're going to address on this episode of Breaking Free from Narcissistic Abuse. Thank you so much for listening in. Please don't forget to subscribe and leave a review. All of us do not like uncomfortable emotions or experiences or things that cause us tension, things that we're in conflict with ourselves, things that are out of alignment with ourselves. And a way to cope with that is that we push it away by using various defense mechanisms. These start right away, start right in infancy, and then as we get older and grow with more reasoning, we develop more sophisticated ones and learn which ones really work for us and which ones don't. What's interesting is that those with more primitive personality disorders, like narcissistic personality disorder, tend to use ones that infancy and toddlers use. For example, they tend to fall into using denial, compartmentalization, projection, and splitting, which causes a lot of problems because they're not very effective and they're very basic. They're kind of a very unique way of seeing the world. It's seeing it in a very black and white terms, and it's instead of dealing with things at a more sophisticated level, it deals with things at a more immature level, which causes a lot of problems, especially for those of us who have to live with those types of people. So I've been thinking a lot about it because one of them that's not well known is called compartmentalization. And we tend to think about this as like putting things in a box. So if I, for example, hold a conflicting opinion about something that I'm not really comfortable with, maybe I have a prejudice that maybe I shouldn't and I'm ashamed of it, I put it in a box and I don't look at it and put it away even though I'm acting on it and it shows up in various areas of my life. But the other thing about compartmentalization is not just segments of life or segments of thought, it's also segments of time and segments of ourselves. I don't know if you've ever noticed, if you've lived around somebody who's like a cluster B personality disorder, how they can actually like be different people with different people. They be a different person. It's as if they put on this persona, this camouflage, this is what we often call a mask. And then when they're with somebody else, they're completely different. And it's as if these two worlds literally never touch, as if there's no continuity between how they were a few minutes ago with someone else and how they are with you now, because they've compartmentalized it. They've put it in a separate spot, a separate location, and it actually doesn't touch. But they do another very unique thing that causes a lot of problems for the rest of the world, and they get mad at us for calling them out on it, is they also segment time. So what happened in this moment is separate from what's going to happen in the next moment, and is separate from what happened just in the moment before, which is why whenever you say, hey, you know, when you did that, you did it yesterday, now you're doing it again, and it's not dealt with, and I'm upset, and they're like, why can't you let go of the past? You're always bringing things up. I thought that was over with. Well, it's not. And there's a pattern. There's a continuity to all of it. We see the consistency, the pattern of it, how it's like before. Only in their minds, because it happened yesterday or happened 5 minutes ago, in their minds, it was a while ago. It didn't happen in this moment. It happened. It's as if it never existed. There's no continuity of time, which, as you can imagine, when it comes to conflict or working on issues, or even when it comes to parenting, say, for example, if you said the two of us have agreed that our son or our daughter is going to do this because of these reasons, they may walk away and say, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't really remember that conversation. For whatever reason, because maybe they weren't completely comfortable with it. Maybe they don't like to deal with conflicts. Maybe they weren't in full agreement. But for whatever reason, the tension caused them to actually put that away as if it never happened. And then that causes you confusion. It's also a form of gaslighting, and it just creates a whole host of problems. I launched into this today just as a way to kind of get us going, but let me introduce myself to you. I'm Dr. Carrie Kerr McAvoy. I'm a licensed psychologist. I have a PhD in clinical psychology, over 20 years of counseling experience, and my specialty is narcissistic abuse and everything related to personality disorders. These days, I mostly write and create content. I also love to educate. And I'm kind of launching a whole host of things this year that I'm super excited about. And one of them you can see is in this label, is that I'm starting a monthly intimate gathering of people around a glass of wine, and we're going to talk about things related to healing to narcissistic abuse. And if you think that you would like just to be one of 20 people in a live, it's a live call, a live chat that we're going to actually talk together face to face. If that sounds interesting, please check out the link in my bio so that you can find out more about it. I'm so excited about that. The first question is, what's the most effective way to manipulate people? Well, that's a kind of interesting kind of back-assward way to talk about manipulation. But I know that's sort of like almost a sort of kind of a tongue-in-cheek question, but let's sort of talk about it different. So manipulation. What is manipulation? Manipulation is really about power and control. Why do we do it? It's about, because the basic rule to all of us is that we want to feel psychologically safe. All of us want to feel safe, and as a result of that, wanting to be safe, we do certain things to manage the safety. And one of the things that we do is, if we don't know how to keep ourselves safe, then we begin to manipulate our environment in order to make it safe for us. Well, we're all in relationships, so how do we do that? Well, we manipulate it by doing kind of strategies that are controlling, manipulative, maybe even deceptive. Maybe we don't know how to be upfront and honest about what's going on in our lives. So as a result, we do odd things to manage our own safety. Now, you can already tell that anything that we do in the environment, one, we don't really have full control over. You can't make people do certain things. You can't guarantee the outcome. But it also, the other problem is that it doesn't really you're not handling the issue yourself. You're not dealing with your feelings about it, your actions about it. Instead, you're handling it out here. So manipulation is really a fancy way of talking about how we manage safety, how we manage our own difficulties and emotional challenges. The better way to do with it is to control what we actually can control, and that is ourselves and our feelings. And so the best way to do this is to process what's going on and understand why we're tempted to act in certain directions, and you know what goes on with what makes us feel uncomfortable. That's a way better way than a manipulation. But common ways of manipulation is being dismissive, shutting conversations down, stonewalling, being contemptuous of something. Of course, there's a lot of discussion about gaslighting. In fact, I just posted a video about that today, different forms of why people gaslight. We can also be manipulative. Lying is a super common way that we are manipulative. We just don't tell the truth. We mislead, or we're not completely in, omission or commission. We're not upfront about our desires. So those are some reasons about why we manipulate and how we manipulate. I love the question, by the way. It's fascinating. And you asked it in a very provocative way, so that's interesting. How do I deal with a narcissist ex who's trying to enter my life again? Well, what happens with certain types of people, a narcissist, people who are on the farther end of the spectrum of narcissistic personality disorder, and by the way, we are all on the spectrum. You have some narcissistic traits, I do too. We're somewhere between super healthy to super pathological. The closer you get to the spectrum, the end of the spectrum, the more likely you're to match the DSM-5 and qualify for a narcissistic personality disorder. But one of the things that happens with people who are more kind of fragilely constructed, psychologically constructed, is that they have this emptiness, this hole. Their self is not well developed, and as a result of that, they then use people and relationships as a way to manage this emptiness, this sense of shame, and this fear of rejection. And so they do that through control and domination and power. So if I'm super insecure, let's use something kind of more innocuous. If I'm trying to think of something off the top of my head that would really work in that direction. You know, if I was really hungry, and I didn't have a good means to getting food, and I saw you eating, I might try to get yours from you instead of me finding a way to get my own. And then I'm going to do really weird strategies in order to convince you to give it to me. I don't know how well of that works as an analogy, but what happens with narcissists is when they have this hole and they don't see people as full people, they don't see you as you with dreams and hopes and wishes, and that if you have fears and you have all this, all the things that make you you, when they don't see that as a result of it, then they use you and they manipulate you, and they think whatever they do is justified because you're not really a person, you're more of an object. It's like using a car or something. So, but when you leave or not in the relationship, they don't let go because they still feel ownership over you. Just in the same way that, you know, have you ever left a job and have kind of felt, found it hard to be able to, you want to keep checking in and wondering how it's going, and it, you know, how's the new person doing and how does that reflect on you? You kind of have a hard time with separating. They do that. They do that even worse. They have extremely difficult time separating. And as a result, they then continue to monitor you, stalk you, hoover, and do all this strategy. And one of the things is they want to pull you back into the relationship if they think you're doing better without them. Because back to the example of a job, you know, imagine you left a job, you thought you did a really great job, and somebody new comes in and it just blows up and does fantastic. Aren't you going to think, maybe I wasn't all as good as I thought I was? Why didn't I think of those things? And you start to feel shaky and insecure. Now let's take it to relationships. If the person, when we're in a relationship with a narcissist, there's an incredible abuse, and the person who's with them and family members do not thrive. They're literally barely surviving. So we're not at our best. And then when we get away from it, we start to heal, we start to do better, and then we look better. And this person who was with us thinks, crap, they're doing better. Well, maybe I missed something that this I didn't know about them, and I need to check them back out again. But maybe I need to go in and reassure myself that they weren't all that. And maybe I just need to mess things up for them again to prove to them that they're not all that, because how dare they do better than that? See, part of the problem with narcissists and sociopaths, psychopaths, is they see the world kind of at war. And so there's a win and lose. There's a lot of envy and competition. And as a result, they end up then wanting to kind of ruin things for other people. That's why they don't really mind hurting you. It's in their view, no one's on their side. It's a tug of war. It's you against them. And it's okay if you get your face planted in the mud, because that then for them just reassures that they're all that. It's super, isn't that a super sad way to live? I find it very painful. But that's why hoovering happens. By the way, let me warn you, if you get caught up in that, and I was hoovered, I did go back for another year, so I know personally from this, it will be worse. Whatever you had before, it's going to be so much more worse. For one, because there's a part of them that doesn't really respect you for taking them back. They feel, because if it, let's use a war analogy. This is a war. They're hoping to degrade you, show to themselves and to you that you're not all that, and then you submit to it? Well, they don't respect that. Now that you're really, like, you know, the paper on the bottom of their shoe, they don't have, so they're, whatever they're going to do, and I'm so glad there's a moderator here now. Thank you so much, Super Sloth Louise. Now, whatever they did to you before, they're going to do way worse because you proved to them that you're susceptible to their tactics. So please, if someone is trying to hoover you back, don't fall for it. I get this question asked a lot. I don't know if it's going to come up today. Is, well, should you ever consider it? Maybe this person's really changed. You know, is that possible? Well, the reason we say narcissists never change is because in order to change, you have to have self-reflection, and you have to take ownership, and you have to have empathy about what is happening to other people. And when you're thinking you're that all that special and that you are entitled to rules that don't apply to everyone else, and you don't have a lot of empathy for what you're doing to other people, and you do think it's all fair and love and war, and it is all war, there's no love, then how are you going to change? How are you going to have any self-reflection? To me, it's like it's a perfect Chinese finger trap. They're afraid of intimacy, and yet it is through intimacy that they get better. But for them, the idea of being known like that is so terrifying, they can't let anyone in. But you can't change unless you let someone in. So because of that, they then can't, you can't change if you can't have self-reflection, if you can't tolerate looking at these very, very difficult things. So can you change? Yeah, but it takes things that narcissists don't tend to have. So it's like this impossible situation. I have known a few who've gotten a lot better with a lot of self-awareness, but they're the rare person because it is so painful. So it isn't that they can't, It's that the very things that allow them to change are the things they're not going to tolerate. And so as a result, they don't change. Oh, okay. If we catch it again, Louise, maybe then you can, there was, I don't know who it was. It was a green icon, but it was back away. So, but if we just watch for the comments, there's so many people here today. And I love it. Thank you so much. I just saw somebody ask, what creates narcissism? I know there's lots of questions that have come in. And so let's talk about that, because I also know I'm sure that's coming in. That's coming in as another question. Like, for example, this person wants to know how to make peace with a narcissistic sister. So in order for us to begin to, let's talk about what creates narcissism. And I know there's a lots of like theories. We really, this is the bottom line is we don't know. We don't know why narcissists are the way they are. I know there's a lot of people who claim it's because early childhood experiences. Yes, that's a part of it. Probably due to attachment issues. Yes, that's a part of it. There's also evidence of possibly genetic implications. Yes, I think that's a part of it. I also think that if there's some brain structural brain differences. By the way, did you know the habits, the way you live, the way you eat, the way you how you take care of yourself, you are affecting your brain. You're literally affecting how it, what gets wired, what grows, what doesn't. You know, your brain at a certain point, when you're born, you have so many neurons. And then around by age of two, there's this big kind of loss, and it sort of like gets into the shape and size of number of neurons it's going to have, you know, the number of cells it's going to have. But from then forward, and yes, they can repair, but over long periods of time. But from then forward, what happens is that it begins to get rich webbing, like think of telephone poles with connections, or think of the internet with all the ways that we connect to each other, the webbing. What you do, how you think, the behaviors you choose, the habits you develop, they strengthen certain connections. They grow certain connections, and the ones that you don't shrink and disappear. They're like pathways. When you stop using it, it gets overgrown. You use it, it gets bigger and more stronger, and it actually shapes and changes your brain. So why do narcissists have brain changes? Is it because this happened through life has created differences in the brain, or were they born that way? See, these are the questions we really don't know. But the theory is, the theory that I was trained in, the idea of where narcissism came from, is that it's partly a developmental phase and stage. Every one of us, when we're born, we don't really know that we're separate from the mom. We think we're part of her. We were literally a part of her until we were born. And in the beginning, we don't really see ourselves as separate. And then we began to realize, wow, she can walk out of the room and she could leave me and I need her. And if I don't have her, I'm going to die. So there's this incredible anxiety, and you see it in the form of infants called separation anxiety. And then there's also stranger anxiety. That's when we begin to aware that we're a separate person and that people come and go in our lives. And so our first basic needs to know that we're safe. And then the next, as we begin to realize that we have this connection with a person, we want them to love us and see us and you know, understand us. And this is called a wish for attunement. And also we want to be idealized. And that's a very normal thing that happens to all of us. But for some of us, for whatever reason, it doesn't go perfectly. And as a result, we don't get either maybe both of these needs met or one need. We might not be mirrored or have good attunement, or we might not be very, remember how like how parents count and kiss their kids' toes and their poop doesn't stink. See, that's that idealization. It's they're perfect. And we all need an experience of that. But if it doesn't get satisfied in a good enough way, then as a result, it leaves a hole. And then we begin to look to outside ourselves to fill it. And it becomes this permanent condition. This I one of my parents is a narcissist. And it, to me, being around this parent felt like this emotional black hole. Like they were like trying to absorb everything that they could within their circle. And it was never enough. Just like with a literal black hole that can't get, it keeps absorbing light and absorbing light. There's never enough. And so that's sort of what it's like. And that's why they're always looking for supply. And the minute that you're not perfect and you're not doing all of these things for them, they start looking for another and then looking for another. They're constantly absorbing this because the dilemma is it needs to be solved by themselves. all of us, all of our psychological issues are things that we need to do and learn to do for ourselves, ultimately. That is adulthood. Now, do most of us psychologically get to do adulthood? Not very well. Not completely. We all have little hiccups and issues that show up for all of us. But when it's severe like this, then it ends up creating this very toxic environment and this big warp. So yeah, that's kind of how narcissism from a developmental standpoint looks like. But yeah, we also think it could be genetic. We think there's some implications about brain changes. We think that there's some implications about as well as upbringing and maybe attachment styles. I think, my personal opinion, I think it's all of the above. I don't think it's one thing. One of the things I used to see, when I was counseling back in the office, I would see people coming with depression. You know, depression is a very common problem. And as a result of that, some people would be depressed because life had been going horrible for them. You know, a lot of situational issues, loss of job, kids are sick, you know, maybe the car broke, no money, and there was just lots of things going wrong. But then somebody else might come in and their life is great. It couldn't go better for them, and yet they're having this depression as well. That was more of a biological-driven depression. And then you see people kind of wear mixes of both all the time. So my point is using depression is I'm saying as many examples as there are of presentations of anxiety or depression or OCD, the same goes for narcissism. Every person has sort of a unique reason why they have narcissistic tendencies, and it's going to be specific to them, yes, we can look for generalities, but it's very unique to each person. So that's why it's very hard for us to say, oh, it's always this or it's always that. No, it's not. It's just lots and lots of reasons. So what do you do when you have a family member that's a narcissist or a spouse that's a narcissist? Maybe it's a child who is. By the way, I use child in the means of an adult child because it can't be diagnosed until you're over 18 years of old. Age. But the thing you're going to have to do is you're going to have to know your own boundaries and what you can tolerate and what you can't tolerate. You're not going to change them, and you can't talk them into being a better person. You only can manage the way in which their toxicity, their pathology affects you, how much contact you're going to have with them, what kind of activities you're going to go have with them. Yes, for some of us, that means go no contact. For other of us, for me, with my parent being aging, it means limited contact. I'm not really feeling free to do no contact. But it's going to differ depending on the situation, depending on your sister's relationship with you, her needs, your needs. It's very complex. But the big thing is for you to recognize where your vulnerability is. Is it that you get dismissed? Is it that she runs the show every time that you're around for vacation? You're going to have to kind of look at that and then say, what do I actually have control over? Should I expose myself to that situation? Can I control the ways in which it's damaging to me without having the whole thing blow up? You know, those are the things I would really evaluate in your situation if it was me. It's tough, you know. I had a hard time with it, managing it in my own family. I found that, you know, I had to take it situation by situation. Do I think people are misusing the word narcissist? I know that that's been a common complaint lately on TikTok and other places, is that we think that we're overusing it. I think there's two ways to kind of think about this. There's a narcissistic personality disorder, which can only be diagnosed by a mental health professional or a doctor, you know, a physician. Thank you for CBS. I see that question. That's a very great question. Make sure you throw it into the interact button, because I really want to talk about why are you hearing therapists not talk about narcissist abuse? Why? Because there is a good reason, and that's an important reason. But there's also narcissistic abuse and narcissistic behaviors, and we all are guilty of that at one time or another. Honestly, I'm going to openly admit to you guys, I've gaslit my kids. I did. They were whining. I wanted to get out of the house. I wanted them to get their coats on so they couldn't leave, and they're fussing. And then I made the issue about them fussing instead of the issue about them getting their damn shoes on. I wasn't addressing the issue. I was making the issue them. The issue was the shoes. The issue was time. When I did that, I was gaslighting. Was that good of me? No, it wasn't good of me. Did I mean to be hurtful? No, I didn't mean to be hurtful. I was just being impatient. How many of us are guilty of that? We've all, at one time or another, I guarantee you, 100% of us have gaslit somebody at some time or another, which is when we make it about the person instead of about the issue. When we distract and move it away as a way to control and manage another person. So yes, we're all guilty of these things. That's, if it's a lot, it's kind of like, this is the rule of thumb in psychology and therapy, and I love this because they taught us really quick in graduate school. Any given problem is not a problem. Let's use something really wild. You wet the bed once in a while, that happens, especially when you're younger. But if it's a constant problem that happens a lot, now that's a problem. We need to look at it. It's frequency or duration of issues. Same goes with narcissistic abuse or all of these kind of toxic behaviors. It's how often is it occurring? How frequently is it occurring? Not that it happens once in a blue moon. I learned better, I stopped doing it. Does a person that you're around stop doing it? Do they learn from their bad behavior and their bad choices? That's the difference from when you have something that's kind of like, you know, human versus something that's pathological. So back to narcissistic abuse, I think that we all at once and another do it accidentally. But then when it starts to move down on further into the continuum, it's problematic. So I do not think we're overusing the word narcissism inappropriately. But I think that if we walked around and said, he's a narcissist, a narcissistic personality disorder, she's a narcissistic personality disorder, I know because they qualify to the DSM-5. Well, you're actually not qualified to diagnose. You're not qualified. In fact, I'm not qualified to diagnose unless I actually meet the person. So you can't come to me and tell me about a whole bunch of symptoms and I can't literally then agree with you because I don't know. I haven't met the person. So that I think would be inappropriate. But to talk about it in the terms of narcissistic behavior, no, I don't think it's inappropriate and I don't think we're overusing it. But I love the question. It's a great question. And I'm going to tie it right into this other, the comment I saw float past while we're doing this is, why do therapists not talk about narcissists? The reason is because we deal with who comes into the room. And usually narcissists don't seek therapy. They don't consider themselves having the problem. The problem is you. You're having the problem with them. Or they see you as the problem, but they're not the problem, even though it's the common denominator is always them. Do you see what I'm saying? So as a result, they don't go into the office and see the counselor. The therapist doesn't have a chance to meet them. And then they don't deal with them. And we're trained, and I actually heard Dr. Ramani say the same thing, and it was what I'd been saying. When we receive clinical training, we're trained to deal with the person in the room. We don't deal with the people who are not in the room. We deal with the person in the room. Because these other people in your life haven't come in with you, we're not taught to think about the fact that your experience is a ramification of maybe someone else's toxicity. That is a blind spot to therapy. Now, I think it's changing. I know it's changing because all of this explosion of interest in social media has forced us to say, wow, we need to be looking at the whole dynamic, that we're all interrelated and we affect each other. If you've got a narcissistic boss, that's going to tear the whole workplace down. It's going to be a toxic place to be. You've got a narcissistic teacher, that classroom is going to be suffering, awful. You have a narcissist as a neighbor, you guys are going to have a rough time when it comes to making policies and keeping compliance as a neighborhood. We're beginning to realize that we need to see that this, we're all connected and that we affect each other. So, but that's why. It's been a blind spot and as a result, but it's changing. I think there's some ways that you can get help, kind of get better treatment, is if you go and you look for someone who's trauma-informed, that understands betrayal trauma, understands the language of narcissistic abuse. So ask. When you go in for therapy, ask. Make sure that they understand these things. My ex didn't leave me and blamed me. Was he narcissistic? I'm not for sure, Sugar Pie, I exactly understand your question. Just because someone you don't get discarded doesn't mean you didn't have a narcissistically abusive relationship. Not every narcissistically abusive relationship results in a discard. There are situations in which the narcissist will go get other supply and then end up making the relationship almost like a roommate situation because they have it kind of comfortable. That maybe they've almost, in fact, I was thinking about this earlier today. It's not uncommon for narcissists, like back to this compartmentalization where I started when I first launched this live. When they're compartmentalizing, sometimes it's almost like a Madonna whore split. They'll see one person is home and creates the safety for the home and you know, keeps things running and is a good administrator. And so they don't have a lot, maybe not a lot of intimacy, but at least it's stable. But then they might go out and do other things in order to get the supply, the adoration, the attention, even the excitement. And so you might find them, you know, doing this odd split like that. So that can happen. And as a result, there won't be a discard as a result of that. So I wouldn't be that. I'm not always surprised. In fact, you know, the toxic relationship I'm in, I suspect he was trying to, there was a con going on and there was a double cross happening. But I also think that I made things comfortable for him. You know, I provided stability for him. I think if I had not fussed and I was willing to sort of go along with it, he might have been more, you know, content to let it be as it was, but I wasn't. So it ended up, he did discard me. But that's another interesting topic, is discards, whether or not the person, you're discarding them or they're discarding you. It's very different. It can be very dangerous when you do the discard. So that's another fascinating topic. Can long-term narcissistic abuse lead to illness? Absolutely. Absolutely, guys. This is what I'm horrified about. In fact, I'm working on a cognitive dissonance course, online virtual course, where you work through independently yourself. And it is all about identifying cognitive dissonance, which is an intrinsic part of narcissistic abuse. So what do I even mean by when I say that? What's a cognitive dissonance? Because I know I'm using a lot of like big terms here. Cognitive dissonance is a fancy way to describe what you feel when you make a decision. So today you had lunch. Maybe you chose between a sandwich and a salad. Maybe you need to lose a couple pounds from COVID, and you probably should have chose the salad, but you're not really into lettuce. And that moment when you had to make the decision of, am I going to do something that's probably better for me healthy-wise, or something that I enjoy and I get more pleasure out of, that conflict, that tension, that's cognitive dissonance. But what do we do? We resolve it as fast as possible. You make a decision, you rationalize your decision, and you move on. When you meet someone who's pathologically ill, they create cognitive dissonance the minute you meet them and until all the way past the relationship is over. At first, you sense something's wrong and off. It creates tension. They're not quite fully present. You wonder if it's you. Then you discover there's been deception or there's been something that's not the way it presents. And then you start to think, do I know them? Who are they? Are they who I think they are? I mean, I never thought they could do this. So what does that mean? And then you think, what should I do? You know, again, that decision. And then you get into the relationship and you stay and you think, why am I staying? I don't really know how to get out. It's going to be problematic. It's going to make everything a mess. What should I do? I don't know what to do. And then you have all the tension around that. And then when you start to get near the end, you start to realize I've made way too many compromises. I don't like who I've become. I've become a caricature of myself. I feel dead. I feel crazy. I don't know what's going on. Who am I? See, there's cognitive dissonance all the way through this whole scenario. Living with that on a long-term basis creates brain changes. Because I already explained how habits and thoughts and behaviors change the wiring of our brain, change their brain. They have found it causes three places of differences. There's more gray matter in the front where you're making executive decisions. Your hippocampus, which is where you have some emotional processing as well as memory consolidation, shrinks. And your amygdala, which is where you feel at threat and uneasy and alarmed, grows. Brain changes. You then grow into a mental fog and you're not making decisions as well. You feel tortured. You are in agony. You can't. And all of that's sort of like escalating. So what do we do about it? You know what? Psychology can't tell you. We don't have any treatment protocols. We haven't been asking these questions. We're just now asking these questions. So this is what I've been doing about it. This is why I wrote my book. I wrote a book called Love You More, The Harrowing Tales of Lies, Sex, Addiction, and Double Cross. I found by writing my book that it brought enormous healing for me because I was able to like literally see it in paper and make incredible conclusions of why I got stuck. What did I miss? What were the early signs? What was real? I'd made so many discoveries about what was real. When I actually looked at, he said, I said, he said, I said, like, There was a moment in one of it where he said he was visiting a son. He came back after that visit super late. He didn't brush his teeth. He got in bed. He wouldn't touch me or kiss me. I now think he was hooking up with somebody. He had cheated, and he didn't want to, like, kind of mess up that experience by touching me, by being with me. But it took me writing it down for me to see that truth. So the fact there's a study in University of Texas in Austin where they found they had two groups of people. They had one just write about what they wore every day, and they had another one write what they're feeling. These people were all unemployed looking for a job. The group that wrote about their feelings, and that's all they did, wrote about their feelings, actually found a job within 2 to 3 months, and the people who wrote about what they were wearing didn't. And it was just journaling created that profound of a difference. Thank you so much, Crappy Lamp, for that. So isn't that incredible? So that's one thing that you can do. We're also finding out that you need to have therapy or healing experiences that involves both the left hemisphere as well as the right hemisphere. A lot of talk therapy is only on the left side, you know, but we need to do both. So that means doing EMDR, getting involved with maybe music therapy or an art therapy, doing things that are kind of more sensory motor, kind of all sorts of things that kind of like go across holistically. And I know psychology is really looking into that more and more work into that, making it more both right and left brain as a result of that. So those are some ideas about how to heal, but those of you who are interested in my course, I'll be offering it later this summer, but I'm also looking for participants to do it for free for a full experience of it, and I'm going to be launching that with them in June. So if you would be open to having, you know, a lot of feedback and giving me feedback and a review and doing it for free, please DM me over Instagram. I would love to add you to that group and see how I want to make sure it's effective before I offer it to everyone else. I appreciate that. And while we're also talking, yeah, if you're open to that, please DM me. Same handle as here. While we're talking about it, I want to tell you this group again in case you have joined me. First of all, I'm Dr. Carrie Kerr McAvoy. I am a licensed psychologist with over 20 years of clinical experience. I don't currently counsel. I get asked that a lot. I don't counsel patients these days, but I do have a referral list. So if you're looking for help, you can't find anyone, DM me over Instagram. I'd be happy to do that. Tatiana, I see that you don't have Instagram. You know what? I'm going to follow you so that you can DM me here. So that way you can get it, because there you go. Now you can DM me here and I can get a hold of you, okay? But I have a monthly topical 90-minute conversation with only 20 people. It's going to be a live webinar experience where we talk about narcissistic abuse and face-to-face these issues, where I get to see you and hear you, and you get to ask questions. It's an open discussion that I'm facilitating. I won't just be doing all education. We'll be doing facilitating. If you find that might be helpful, interesting, it's called Wine with Dr. Carrie. Please look for tickets. The first one is May 12th at 6:30 Eastern Standard Time, and I would love to have you join me for that. The first topic is going to be, how do I forgive myself for falling in love with the wrong person? And then June's topic is going to be, how do I find healing when I can never fully understand why this person hurt me? So those are the next 2 months, and I would love to see you guys do that and love to hang out with you for that. This is a great question. I am so glad you guys asked me about what goes on legally. How do you deal with it? Because I know the court systems are not proactive. They're actually just really abusive. They just, the people who are toxic use the court system, and it's kind of blind spot as a way to beat up the person that they're discarding, or to beat up the person who's discarding them. So one of the things that happens is that narcissistic people are really good at creating a setup for you in which they anticipate what you might do. They know you really well. That's why they're able to camouflage and love bomb you. They can anticipate your actions really well. And so they get it to where they set it up to where you're triggered and you react, or they bring the worst out of you, and then you end up fulfilling everything that they said about you. You look hysterical. You look abusive. You look like you're the narcissist. And as a result, it ends up then diminishing and kind of losing credibility for you. I actually got to hear Dr. Romani in person. I went to a seminar just recently where she was speaking, and she said, I tell my clients they cannot use the word narcissistic abuse, and they cannot say he's a narcissist. It's just not allowed to do that, because immediately you lose credibility when you're in the court system. So what do you do? How do you get around that? There is a way to get around it, and I'm going to tell you how to do it. You want to use words like, this person said this on this date. She did this and blew up in the driveway, screaming these things. These neighbors were around and heard it, and it happened at 6:30 at night. He did this. He said this to our child on these occasions, and our child then did this in response. You want to make it very practical, very objective. It needs to be almost like measurable, like observable. And I want you to create a running like a running notebook. Get a note, literally a notebook, a spiral notebook. Use a black pen in the United States. It's because black, believe it or not, is what you do to create a legal document. This is what you're going to be doing, creating a legal document. And so every single time something happens, you write where, when, and what time and sign it in black ink. And you do it very, don't make any like assumptions. Don't make any conclusions. Don't say, I think he hurt my children's feelings. No, you don't know that. You know what they said. You know how my child went to the room and wouldn't come out for 3 hours, and I heard them crying. You can say that. You witnessed that. But you can't make conclusions. So those are the things that I would really urge you to do, is create a running document of actions and reactions. And then you have something to you can actually show it's escalating. You can show that it's abusive by the proof. You can show how harmful it is to the family, to yourself, to your children. You know, those are the things that has power when you go into the courtroom. So that's what I would recommend that you do. But stay away from psychological words, because what's going to happen is when you're on the stand, they're going to say, are you a clinical psychologist? How do you know that? No, I'm not. Well, then right there, all of it gets tossed out. It's just meaninglessness. They're going to say, oh, there's another like hysterical woman again, you know. But so that's how the best way to avoid this is just keep it to behavior. Keep it specific to what's said, done, and the reaction to that. Great question. I'm really glad that you asked that. And I know there needs to be so much catching up. By the way, I don't know how many of you guys follow Lisa Soni called Stronger Than Before. She does webinars. She has one coming up in June. I don't know a whole lot about it yet, like the date. But what I would recommend, it's on co-parenting with a narcissist. So what I would do is I would highly recommend that you check out, if you're not already following her, check it out. Look for the link in her bio, because she's going to have a judge as part of that panel. She's going to have a psychologist, a judge, and it's going to be a really great discussion about, and it will address these types of kind of co-parenting legal issues. Yeah. What's the difference between narcissist and borderline? So the DSM-5 is what we currently use to diagnose behaviors. And when we look at someone, we have what's called 5 axes. In each axis stands for something different. The first one is there a mental disorder? That includes depression. Her name is Lisa Soni. You want it stronger than before. It's undercase stronger, undercase then, and then undercase before, stronger than before. That's the name of the webinar person, Lisa Soni, S-O-N-N-I, Lisa Soni. Strong, yes, thank you. Stronger than before. Good friend of mine. Oh, I love her so much. She's awesome content. She's all about trauma bonds. So she's an amazing creator. Yeah, so axis one is mental conditions. That's things like bipolar disorder, depression, anxiety, all of that. Axis two, when you're a child, is developmental issues. But when you're an adult, it's personality disorders. So those are the things that have to do with relationships, way that you are around others. The bipolar disorder is a mental disorder. It's a mental condition. Yes, it does. There are some things about it that are sort of narcissistic, maybe, but they're not narcissists. And it's a mental condition, and it responds to medication. It responds to treatment. So yes, there are periods in where they're very kind of hyped up and they're very grandiose, but it's specific to a very period of time of mania. And then when the mania resolves, it disappears. And then they may actually do the opposite. They may sink into this incredible dark period where they're either, you know, very irritable and angry, or where they feel very hopeless or very empty. So it's a condition of swings, mental swings between like hyper kind of excessiveness it's mania, which, but it can form, it can kind of present in lots of different ways, to then when it sinks into this depression. And it moves in and out pretty, for some people very slow, other people faster. That's why there's type 1 and type 2. So that's would be a mental condition. Narcissism is a personality disorder. It is enduring. It's the way they consistently relate to people and to others and to their job. It's how they see themselves in the world and see other people to them. So it's the style of relating, style of viewing the world. That's how the two are very different. So one is temporary. It's a sickness. It's an illness. And the other is a way of relating. That would be kind of the best way to kind of describe that. There are two really kind of interesting questions. I'm just going to pull these out as a result of that. One is, are boys more likely to be narcissistic? Why? Yes, they are more likely to be narcissistic. Why is that? I've kind of been doing some thinking about that. Why boys are more prone. The statistics are they're about 2 to 1 woman to 3 to 1. So 2 men to 1 to 3 men to 1 are more likely to be narcissists than women. By the way, it's not that women don't have their issues. We do. We're more likely to be borderline personality disorders. They're less likely. So isn't that interesting? So, but why? I think part of it is the way we raise children, the way what we've allowed men to express and not. So when you think about it, if you kind of look at the disorders, the way they handle emotions is very unique. Narcissists tend to compartmentalize and shut emotions off. They tend to be kind of disconnected from emotions. That makes a lot of sense, right? We don't allow our boys to be emotional. We say, suck it up. We tell them, quit being a wuss. We call them ladies when they show emotions on the football field. So we've really in fact, here's another fascinating way. They looked at how mothers held boy babies versus girl babies. Mothers were more likely to hold the girl into herself with her face, the girl's face into her mother's chest. They were more likely to hold boys' babies facing outward to the world. Isn't that interesting? Like, we don't even hold our children the same based on their gender. I mean, it starts right from the moment that they're born. We have all these kind of stereotypical expectations. And so as a result of that, are we surprised men struggle with more softer emotions, that they shut it off, that they've learned a way to deal with painful affect is to control people? And then they see all the modeling around them with the power, but the men use power more often than we do it relationally. They do it through hierarchy and systems. Borderline personality disorder is a dysregulation of emotions. That's a falling apart. It's like chaos. Well, if women are allowed to be more emotional and it's okay, but we don't have good structure inside of us to handle it, we're more likely then to be impulsively emotional, right? We're more likely like to cry for hours on days and then, sink into the ice creams, Whereas a guy, he's more likely to get cross, chew somebody out and stonewall them, right? So you can see how we've kind of made it a cultural thing, a patriarchy thing. So I think by the way, this is just superficial. Don't quote me as this is the reason, but those are some thoughts about it. I think it's very embedded in our culture, very embedded. So I have a feeling if we got healthier, we'd see the stats changing. I'm sure of it. I don't think this is actually because men are men. I think it's kind of the way that we've allowed men to show up. And so partly it's on all of us. There is another question that came in that I thought was really an interesting question I want to pull out of the group as well. So this person is asking, I want to leave and I have a feeling there is concern. And I agree, there is concern. One of the best ways to know, you need to always assess lethality. How dangerous is your partner? And by the way, I have a questionnaire that I offer just for free. If you want to have the questionnaire, please check out the links in my bio. It will take you to it. I have a questionnaire on, are you in a relationship with someone who has a sex addiction? Are you in a relationship with someone who's dangerous? I have both of those are surveys that I've created. So if you'd like to check them out, my only request is that you give me your email for that, and then I'd be happy to have you have the quiz, and it gives you the results. But everybody has a potential to be lethal. The best prediction of danger is a past history of danger. So even if it's not with you, but if you know this person's had trouble before, is there like vandalism? Are they throwing things? Are they, you know, is it happening at the office? If you're seeing this, this is a way for you to know this person's more dangerous. Leaving a person who's more narcissistically constructed is an incredible narcissistic wound. It will create an incredible sense of rejection and bring up tremendous shame for them. They're more likely to be impulsive and to decompensate on you. So my best advice is make a good plan. Know where you're going to go. Have money made ahead. Get it all in place and ready to go. And yeah, really have a good exit plan. And talk to an attorney before you go. Make sure you know how it works with a home. Make sure you know how it's going to work with custody with the kids. Don't make any move legally until you are exactly for sure what your legal rights are and what the ramifications are. I would also prepare work because this person may be showing up at work and creating problems. So I would make sure that you have a plan in place for that. But think about it financially, think about it legally, think about it with regards to custody, and think about it regards to safety. Make sure there's nothing in your house that's dangerous. If you have things that are dangerous, make sure they're locked up or out of the house. Get them out of the house if you can. Just think about all these types of areas. So I would make sure that you really think this through and have a plan and know exactly financially, legally what you're going to do. Because if your person is impulsive, guys, this is really, really great. I know there's so many questions you're coming in, and this was an amazing time today, really. I'm so excited. One of them is, I believe we'll be interviewing Dr. Kristen Milstead. I'm so, so excited about this. She is the author of this book, Why Can't I Just Leave? She has agreed to be interviewed. Why Can't I Just Leave? We're going to be doing a 90-minute to a two-hour event with her. We'll be selling tickets for it. I think it's going to be either August or September. I'm super excited. And we'll have replays available to buy if you can't make it that night. So pay attention to kind of like watch my link because exciting things are going to be happening. So yes, lots happening. I'm super excited about this, guys. Thank you so much for following me and joining me. Thank you for sharing my stuff. Thank you for all of it. I'm really excited about this. Thank you, guys. Bye-bye.